For those of you who don't know, it's a very small unit in Oxford University. We are some of the last people in a European university still studying the deeply unfashionable subject of fossil fuels. But here, what I'm going to really talk about is geopolitics. And I wanted to start with a couple of fairly broad slides in terms of energy geopolitics, because you may well be aware of the European position on this, that essentially Putin's Russia doesn't share values and rule-based legal systems and uses energy and gas as a geopolitical weapon. You're probably not so familiar with the Russian position, which if you visit Russia regularly, you will hear from very many people that essentially the European position on values is completely bogus. I say to people that we don't need to agree with this, we just need to be aware that there is a very strong Russian position and it is very well formulated when you participate in seminars anywhere in Russia. The whole geopolitical climate and essentially trust between the two sides has of course massively deteriorated since the Ukraine crisis, and I would say that relations today are perhaps a little better than they were a year ago, but not very much. What does this mean specifically for gas? Well, what it really means is that you tend to find the arguments that it's geopolitically unacceptable to depend on Russian gas. And this is really because of the ability that it gives to the Russian side to limit freedom of action of European countries in terms of foreign security policies. You get a lot of divide and rule, you know, Russia picks out country X and makes sure that it doesn't participate in certain other things that would be good for Europe. And it also supposedly limits the freedom to impose political and economic sanctions on Russia. And that the only remedy for this is essentially just to terminate Russian gas supplies and to either use other gas or other energy in Europe. I have to say that I don't find that these arguments are actually empirically sound as I look at and indeed have lived through much of the history of Soviet and now Russian European gas relations. But they are, for politicians and media people in Europe, they are very widely held. I would say that, you know, if one's making broad generalisations, you hear these views most strongly in the Baltic countries and Poland. The further south and east you go, you don't hear them nearly as much. You hear more a sense of the fact that dependence on Russian energy is inevitable, and that the people recognise there are certain threats, but they are not so alarmed by those threats. We have interesting tests coming up of these propositions, because a number of contracts, long-term gas contracts between Gazprom and the smaller countries in the Baltics and Southeast Europe are beginning to expire. So we shall see whether the geopolitical test of essentially saying, right, well, once they expire, we terminate, we don't extend. We'll see how that works out in practice. There's a lot of ways of measuring European dependence on Russian gas. This is what I call the simple arithmetic method, which is you simply take European demand and say how much comes from Russia. It's deeply, deeply misleading. But when I appear, as I occasionally do, in front of our elected representatives in London, the first question they always ask is, how much Russian gas does the UK use? And I have to go into this very long explanation of, well, what exactly do you mean by Russian gas? Do you mean gas that comes from Russia? Or do you mean gas that's sold by Russian companies? And they get irritated because they think, you know, I'm just being a pedantic academic. And the answer is, well, if you mean gas that actually comes from Russia, the answer is, we don't know, and nor do they, because it's almost impossible to trace molecules from Siberia crossing the channel. But this is an absolute preoccupation for particularly UK politicians and media people. So what you see from this chart is that actually the dependence in simple arithmetic terms has been relatively stable in the post-Soviet period. But every so often, people get very excited about it. And there is a reason to get quite excited about it in relation to certain countries. This is a quote from an EU energy security strategy, whereby they single out six member states which depend either wholly or largely on Russian gas. And they're member states that people, particularly people in the UK, don't think about very much. But they are important because for these countries, dependence and therefore vulnerability and therefore the security arguments can be very powerful. And certainly in, I would say, the Baltic states, not so much in Bulgaria and Slovakia, you will find a great many people who will argue that Russia has used gas as a political weapon. As I say, our research tends to show something a little bit different, and we can perhaps go into that if people are interested in the Q&A. However, the work that we have done suggests that, in fact, one could resolve a number of the problems of highly dependent countries, because Lithuania now has a liquefied natural gas import terminal. Poland ought to have had its terminal by now, and every time I read about its terminal, it's 2 or 3 months away from being opened. So I can't really tell you what the status of it, except that sometime in 2016, the Polish terminal will be operational. The Lithuanian terminal is capable of importing a substantial amount of gas, which can nearly, not completely, can nearly supply the entire Baltic region. One thing to keep in mind when you hear about Baltic people, as they receive a lot of publicity, is this is a very, very small gas market in European terms. All of the countries use far less than 10 BCM a year, which is a very small amount of gas. But they get a lot of publicity because they are wholly, or they have been until the terminal opened, wholly dependent on Russian gas. The Bulgarians have a slightly more complicated situation. They will receive some gas from Azerbaijan. It's possible that they'll receive some Romanian gas, and in fact the Romanians may become exporters next year when their new fields start up. But for many of the former Yugoslav republics, which are not EU members and therefore attract less publicity, these are such small markets that even a very small amount of gas would make a big difference to their dependence on Russia. There is, however, a very significant question, which is, how much does all of this cost? And who pays for that? And this is important because even a small LNG terminal of the type that the Lithuanians have, we're talking somewhere in the region of 350 million euros. For a larger terminal, such as the Polish terminal, we're talking over €1 billion. So potentially this is quite large sums of money. And it appears that the general view of the European Union and European solidarity is that European member states as a whole, through various funds, will pay a very substantial part of the capital cost. Which is fine, but we need to be really clear that reducing dependence and therefore geopolitical threat has a cost. And the cost can be very substantial. So that's an important dimension of the geopolitical arguments that is rarely aired in public. So if that was a little bit about the commodity, This is more about transportation. And the major, I would say, current argument between the EU and Russia, that essentially the long-term transit through Ukraine, just reminding you that most Russian gas historically came through Ukraine through this route. We have one pipeline, the Yamal Europe pipeline, going through Belarus of more recent vintage, and I'll show you the others in just a moment. So the idea that the Russian position is that essentially Ukraine is not a reliable transit country and never has been, and therefore transit through Ukraine must be eliminated. And the EU policy since the Ukraine crisis, prior to the Ukraine crisis, shall we say, there was not a great deal of attention devoted to Ukraine by the European Union. But since the Ukraine crisis, the policy has become very much that transit through Ukraine must be maintained for geopolitical reasons, because otherwise Russia will be allowed to isolate Ukraine and essentially use gas as a political weapon. And that alternative pipelines, such as the ones Russia is proposing and I'm about to show you, are not needed. And this is an interesting position from the EU, because for Brussels to decide which pipelines are needed and not needed is in fact a commercial position, which is something that Brussels is supposed to be avoiding, because that's what commercial companies are supposed to do. But as I said, where we were probably about 10 years ago was that Ukraine was dominant and the Yamal Europe pipeline was then built as the first transit avoidance pipeline. This was as a result of very bad experience in the 1990s, in the immediate post-Soviet period, with Ukrainian failure to pay and theft of gas. What then happened was the first two Nord Stream, actually it didn't happen first, but this is the way I'm showing the slides, the first two Nord Stream pipelines were built in 2011 and 2012, and just a little bit earlier this year, a group of slightly different European companies signed a shareholders agreement with Gazprom to build the pipelines 3 and 4. And the reason that that's obviously important is that the first two lines were resisted, particularly by the Baltic states and, of course, Ukraine. And if they were to build these lines 3 and 4, that would substantially reduce the amount of gas that was going through Ukraine. In fact, the next line after the Yamal pipeline was built was Blue Stream, which is the line that goes directly across the Black Sea to Turkey. Turkey having become Gazprom's second biggest export market after Germany. The Turkish market is of vital importance. Chronologically, what the Russians were planning on doing was building the South Stream pipeline, which is what you see greyed out, the four lines you see greyed out leading to Bulgaria. They were informed by a series of regulatory decisions from Brussels that it was going to be very difficult or even perhaps impossible for them to build South Stream for regulatory reasons. And therefore they reoriented this line and called it Turkish Stream, towards the Turkish mainland, which in fact, given the fact that Turkey is such an important market for them, is a very sensible thing to do. But of course, Turkey not being an EU member means that Brussels has nothing to say about the regulation of those pipelines. Cutting an extremely long story as short as I can, our work suggests that there will not be four Turkish Stream pipelines. There will be one and possibly two, but the second one will have to supply some gas to EU countries. Even the first one has been significantly delayed by the current substantial dip in relations between Russia and Turkey over ISIS and Syria and a whole lot of other issues. So we believe that Turkish Stream 1 will go. We're not sure when, probably sometime before 2020. And as a result, transit through Ukraine will be reduced by about 15 or 16 BCM. We think that will probably be the first new line to get built sometime before 2020. So if we look at the politics of this as opposed to the economics and the regulation, which is very, very complicated, at the moment, sanctions are making it extremely difficult for any Russian companies to borrow money on international markets. This is despite the fact that most of the sanctions do not apply to Gazprom, do not apply to gas pipelines, and could not be said to infringe any of the either US or EU rules. But banks have become so tremendously risk-averse that they don't want to take any chances that it might be interpreted sometime in the future that by lending to these projects, they were somehow breaking the spirit of sanctions. So it is becoming very difficult for Russian companies to raise money. In addition to that, the EU is very effectively using the third energy package, which, again, for those of you who are not familiar with this, is a very large group of new regulations, highly complex network codes for the gas and the electricity industry, but in this case gas. They're very effectively using this to block the development of new pipelines. And essentially, many member states, basically, if Russia wants something, that's a good reason for them to oppose it. These are, in my view, political and geopolitical positions, which is not to say they're wrong, it's just to say this is the subject of our seminar. Therefore, it's very interesting that this is actually, this is how the world of new pipelines in Europe is evolving. So, what should be, on the face of it, about gas supply and regulation? In other words, what our work has done and continues to concentrate on is how much gas from Russia and elsewhere will Europe need? When will it need it? What are the regulations governing these pipelines and how will they evolve in an EU context? Is in fact now increasingly about geopolitics and the determination from Putin to reduce dependence on Ukraine. Partly it has to be said for commercial, but given the relations between Russia and Ukraine for political reasons. And from the EU side, despite their continued mantra that as long as Russia conforms with the new EU regulation, it can build new pipelines. Of course, there are lots of ways to stop Russia building these pipelines, and the determination to maintain Ukraine as a transit country is such that we think that Brussels will use those powers that it has wherever it can, which is basically everywhere other than Turkey, to stop Russia building new pipelines and maintain the Ukrainian corridor. I want to finish by saying that in this context, definitions are everything, and particularly definitions of security. So the trilemma was mentioned, but security of supply can mean anything that anybody wants it to mean in terms of what you might be a little bit concerned about from compared with how you see the geopolitical threats. Basically, the Russians are using security arguments just as much as the EU are using security arguments, but meaning something completely different. So with that, and just I added this in case people are interested in taking a look at the papers that we've written on this and our book on Russian gas. Thank you very much indeed.
Right, thank you, Professor Stern. Dr. Chong.
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me to participate in this seminar series. And I would like just to say that I'm very honored to have this opportunity to actually comment on Professor Tern's talk, because Yes, when I did my PhD on Russian gas export policy, I actually used a lot of Jonathan's books and papers, and I found even a book on Soviet gas dated back in 1989 by Professor Stern. So I was reading all of his books and comments on the subject. So I really wanted to comment on probably going from in the reverse order, because I was working on the two case studies for my PhD thesis on the Nord Stream pipeline investment and South Stream. And well, the reason for choosing the two case studies is very simple. I wanted to understand to what extent Russia is using gas as a geopolitical weapon. So, and investment in those two pipelines gave me great opportunities for exploring these sort of questions. But I came from the angle of more sort of like quantitative and trying to understand the rationale, the economic rationale behind the investment in those projects as a company, as a private company would approach those sort of projects. So, and what I found is that actually, you know, if taking the Nord Stream as a case study, because at the time when Nord Stream was proposed, I think, and has been agreed between Gazprom and various European companies back in 2005, I believe, or 2006, when they signed the agreement for investing in the first sort of pipelines that would take gas directly from Russia to Germany. And at that time, the Ukrainian sort of like Orange Revolution back in 2004 also happened, with a lot of sort of transition from the sort of like view that the dictatorship regime in Ukraine towards more sort of like Western lean regime led by Yushchenko and Timoshenko and the rest of the team. So it was within that context that I thought that Nord Stream as a case study was a great case study, because for one reason, Nord Stream also would allow Gazprom to reduce the dependence on Ukraine. And as you know, probably anything to do with harming Ukraine's economic and financial position also harms the political position. And therefore, it's a multifaceted question on the investment in the pipelines. So what I so I took the case study and look into a very detailed sort of analysis. At that time, I do recall that I probably knew what sort of like factors supplied the compressor station for the pipeline. So I analyzed that in great depth and details. And the main conclusions that I made out of the case study analysis is actually, you know, what Nord Stream, even without this sort of like political consideration of reducing dependence on Ukraine, makes sense for Russia to invest, because it's, first of all, it's a cheaper sort of like options to transport gas from the newly emerging region of Western Siberia and Yamal Peninsula, which is a new production base for Gazprom, and that would allow Gazprom to ship directly to Germany, which is one of the liquid market and emerging sort of like traded market. So that was one of the rationale that, you know, even forgetting about Ukraine and comparing the Nord Stream route to the Ukrainian alternative as a transit option, for example, because the Ukrainian transit corridor is much longer than the Nord Stream pipeline, because of this shift in the production base from the old fields to the new fields, and they're supposed to Nord Stream supposed to serve those sort of new production fields. And then secondly, I also found that while if you factor in the Ukraine's sort of like monopoly position on transporting the marginal volumes of Russian gas to Europe, then it even makes more sense for Gazprom to invest in the pipelines, because that reduces Ukraine's bargaining position, because, you know, otherwise Gazprom would only have two options to transport gas to Europe, one of them being through Yamal Europe pipeline that goes through Belarus to Poland and then to Germany, and the second obviously is Ukrainian pipelines system. So without the Nord Stream, Ukrainian position would be, in terms of the economics and strategic sort of consideration, game theoretic consideration, would of course enhance Ukraine's position, and therefore I found that these are the sort of like economic rationale. But then the question that I sort of the question that left unanswered really by my thesis is, well then, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm more clever than Gazprom strategists, and they of course know all of these sort of benefits, why they're investing billions of dollars with their European partners just for sake of bypassing Ukraine as such. So, and the question remains that why then in the public domain on discussing the pipelines, in discussing the investment in Nord Stream, Gazprom took the official position that, you know, it's improving security of supply. And I actually found in my dissertation that, and my research at that time, is that, you know, the security value of the pipeline in case of disruption of the Ukrainian transit corridor is just marginal compared to all other benefits that it could give Gazprom and Russia, in the sense of ensuring a lower transit fee through Ukraine because of reducing the bargaining power of Ukraine, but also because of the shorter route through this new pipeline. So the security value is really marginal. It ranges from 5 to 10% of the entire economic valuation of the pipeline. And then my question was, and I couldn't sort of answer and leave it for sort of political scientists probably to shed light on, is that why Gazprom and Russia championed the project on the ground of security of supply and not just discussing directly with European officials that, you know, this is the project that would allow Russian gas to be more competitive and hence probably lowers the entire gas prices probably for Europe. And it actually also makes sense because if one looks at other competitors' supplies responses, let's say Statoil or Norway, and this where the Statoil was one of the first company who actually responded to the shift in the markets by actually reducing the long-term contract take or pay, but also introducing a lot of spot indexation. And one of the reasons is just very simple. If you look at the geography of Norway versus Russia, you can see that, you know, out of the 6 delivery points of Norwegian gas, they all land in the liquid and trade hubs in Europe that has emerged. And the distance between the Norwegian production base to UK, to west, northwestern European markets is just 1,000 to 2,000 kilometers versus from the West Siberia to Russia, which is 4,000 to 6,000 kilometers. So if European Commission wants Russia to respond in a rational way, then probably European Commission would also need to allow Gazprom to build a direct connection, because, you know, I think that in spot trading and liquid hub markets is in a nutshell, when the markets are deep and liquid, it's a replacement for the long-term bilateral contracts. That's what essentially it is about, because in the old days of the gas markets, the funding of the trade and also investment were relied on these large long-term bilateral contracts between large companies like Gazprom, E.ON, and a few other companies who were backed at that time by their states. So, but when liquid markets emerged, and that's if you want to hedge against different risk in the market, you go to the market for hedging products. So you don't need bilateral contracts to hedge your position as such. So if one wants to for Russia to respond rationally, then one wants Russia to be able to connect to the to trade hubs, because otherwise transporting all the Russian gas through Ukraine takes a lot of time and also efforts to ensure that Ukraine behave in a rational way as well. But and that also leads me to few other comments on Ukraine and Russia and European Union is that, essentially what European Union has embarked on is to integrate Ukraine into its European energy market through Third Energy Package and through the European Energy Community as a vehicle to engage with the third countries who are not members of the EU. And of course, if one looks at how the past year has evolved between Russia, Ukraine, and Europe, and just look at how difficult it was for the three parties to agree on financing Ukraine's purchase of gas, because that has been discussed quite a lot in the media, and you probably know that they have just reached an agreement that the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development would give some money, World Bank would give some money, and it's very surprising because EBRD is not supposed to fund the operational sort of like to fund the operational issue of the company. The main purpose, as I understand, for EBRD is to fund the project that would make economic development, like in Central Asia or Ukraine and etc. So that would meet some sort of like sustainability and impactful that would make an impact on the wider economy. But it's very strange to see that EBRD is actually agreed to fund just this sort of like credit bridge, in a nutshell, giving money to Naftogaz to Ukraine to buy gas from Russia just because it to safeguard the transit flows for this coming winter. So what I'm trying to say is that although maintaining Ukraine as a transit country is a political objective of European Commission, but I agree with Professor Stern is that all those sort of geopolitical considerations have a cost. So yes, and therefore maintaining Ukraine in sort of like as a transit country will necessarily involve higher cost, both because of the political discussions around the funding for Ukraine, because this is not just for this winter that probably Ukraine need money, but for the next and perhaps next 2 or 3 years before actually some of the reforms of the Ukrainian energy markets comes through and take effects on the financial sustainability of Ukraine as a country, but also Naftogaz as a company to purchase gas and ensuring the security of supply through Ukraine. So that's the dilemma for the European Commission, whether it wants to support the alternative pipelines as strictly a security of supply consideration, or now the security of supply is a wider definition than just the security of supply that I think the most of us used to think. Now that incorporates also geopolitical consideration, and especially given the case study on Russian gas with the EU and Ukraine. So I think I'll stop here, and looking forward to Q&A. So thank you.
Thank you, Colm. Richard?
Thanks. So I should just first of all apologize if my voice is a bit crackly. I'm just recovering from a cold, so I'm hoping it will be fine. So I just wanted to thank Mark actually for inviting me to comment on this really interesting topic. I should begin with a caveat to say I'm not a specialist in European-Russian energy relations, but I am an anthropologist who works on energy issues primarily in China and Mongolia. So I thought it would be interesting, as we discussed, what would an anthropologist do in this kind of topic? How would an anthropologist approach some of these issues? And I guess my first kind of gut reaction would be to begin with a bottom-up approach. I would turn, as anthropologists like to do, to ethnographic studies, to ethnography. So in this context, I would like, or I would aim to locate a particular ethnographic field site, or perhaps a number of related ethnographic field sites, from where one could do long-term ethnographic field work. Now, the aim of this would be really to explore the kind of on-the-ground everyday social dynamics behind these energy relations. And out of this ethnographic particular, we aim to sort of tease out broader geopolitical and national configurations. Now, the topic in itself is, of course, really interesting for an anthropologist because you have so much material presence of energy in this part of the world. So you have pipelines which flow across borders. You have, in the Russian case, a very strong state-led energy sector. You have a number of international border issues. And of course, just simply, you also have the working lives of the actual people at the extraction points themselves, which I think would be an absolutely fascinating issue. Now, particularly in a Russian context, you also have an important ethnic dimension. And I just wanted to sort of bring your attention to a really interesting anthropological study of energy extraction on the Yamal Peninsula. And this is by a German anthropologist called Florian Stammler. So you'll find that whenever an anthropologist wants to talk about something, somebody's already done an ethnographic study of that place. And he's got a book called Reindeer Nomads Meet the Market. And of course, at first glance, this sounds like a classic anthropology story about some peripheral group of people living outside the market. But actually, what he wants to show, and he does it particularly well, is how these particular reindeer nomads living on the Yamal, of course, have never been isolated. And particularly in relation to oil and gas extraction, are fundamentally tied to all kinds of processes going on in Russia and, of course, beyond in Europe more generally. Reindeer herders in the Yamal, of course, have a really interesting socialist history where you had a really strong collectivized state apparatus in place on how to support reindeer nomadism in that part of the world. And what Stammler has really shown is how the interaction between these reindeer nomads in the Yamal and the energy sector, actually the energy sector is actually supporting reindeer nomadism, mobility, and what we would call traditional lifestyles up in the Yamal. And the way in which they're doing that is because the infrastructure that's built around the energy industry actually goes to support the lifestyle of herders in that part of the world as well. So you have helicopters, you have boarding schools, you have transportation infrastructure, you of course have flows of capital and access to markets that wouldn't be there if the energy extraction wasn't taking place in that part of the world. So what Stammler's study shows us isn't just how reindeer nomadism is actually supported by the energy industry, but also how in the process we see quite different attitudes to energy itself, different cultural attitudes to energy. How a Nenette reindeer herder in Yamal experiences energy in a kind of visceral sense is very different to those oil workers or those administrators or state employees who are sent out and positioned in very similar environments to where these reindeer nomads might be living. But one of the things that Stammler shows is how through their incorporation into that energy sector, they actually come to take on many new political subjectivities around how they think about energy and Russia's role of energy in relation to Europe. So what you find is some of the strongest advocates of Putin in relation to energy policy are these reindeer nomads. Because, of course, they see a strong Russia as fundamentally tied to being a strong cultural identity for themselves as Nenets, ethnic minority people. So I just wanted to sort of raise that example because it is quite interesting to think more about the materiality of energy in certain parts of the world. So I work in northeast China and you have the Daqing oil pipeline between which cuts across the Sino-Russian border. And I knew about the existence of this pipeline for a long time and people always mentioned it as if it was something peripheral. But when you go there, actually you see all of that kind of material manifestation, the pipelines, the power lines, the platforms, even the engineers, the state officials who go and have meetings in these areas, all of that becomes part of the sort of broader state vision of that area and which direction that area is supposed to go. So all of the policies which affect the people with which I work, who actually have nothing to do with that, the energy industry, are indirectly tied to all of those other policies and processes that are taking place up there. Now, I think both of those examples are quite useful in the sense that they highlight the issue of energy in terms of power. That is to say, who has energy, who is empowered by energy flows, and who isn't. So an anthropological approach, usually based on long-term fieldwork, drawn from a particular ethnographic site or multiple sites, might help to reveal the microphysics of power on the ground, how these microphysics come to be reproduced through everyday social relations, and importantly, what are the implicit cultural presuppositions, attitudes, and experiences of energy behind this, what we are calling geopolitics. Because, of course, there's a whole series of very implicit, I would say, and very taken for granted attitudes to what energy is, what is energy for, who is energy benefiting and who is it not, at that geopolitical level. Now, anthropologists have long studied what we call the cultural experience of energy, so different ideas about energy. And it's true to say that energy is experienced, described, and presented to people in different parts of the world in very different ways. In some cases, energy is something that's simply invisible, it's taken for granted. In other cases, it's omnipotent, it's magical, it's animistic. But for many others, it's a symbol of modernization, it's a symbol of development, it's something needed. And for others, it's unreliable, it's costly, and it's polluting. So I think the important question from a geopolitical perspective and from a policy perspective is, how do these multiple meanings and experiences of energy come to intersect? How do they articulate? And why is it that a particular experience of energy or attitude of energy comes to dominate above others? And I would say that that then becomes the geopolitical definition of energy. Now, I think particularly in a Russian context, I don't know much about Russia, but I do work quite close to the Russian border. And I know that it would be impossible to think about a Russian geopolitical perception of energy without first understanding other culturally specific experiences and notions in that part of the world, such as the landscape, the environment, legality and illegality, bureaucracy. How do people imagine citizen-state relations in that part of the world versus, for example, in Europe? So I think an ethnographic approach or an anthropological approach would be quite useful to capture these various contested meanings, particularly given quite long socialist histories. I really liked some of the descriptions in the paper that you gave us to read, how many of the pipelines carry names such as brotherhood and friendship, and you see this on the Mongolian Chinese side as well. So as an anthropologist, I'm immediately drawn to that because I immediately see, energy relations are all about kinship, right? It's all about how people imagine themselves and their neighbors. So in that sense, I think there's a really interesting social anthropological aspect. Now, the usual studies of energy, such as the one I mentioned by Florian Stammler, tend to prioritize the local, right? So the local, in this case, the Nenets' experience of energy, while looking at it in a broader context. But I think the point is that there's no reason why one actually has to do that, right? One can actually take as one's starting point, really, the multiplicity or the transnational flows of all of these different attitudes and experiences of energy. So anthropologists more recently who've been looking at flows across, such as this example, transnational flows, look at really energy scapes across local, national, and transnational levels, and how, as the energy flows from one domain to the next, its particular cultural, economic, political values change as they go along. So that sort of allows us to kind of map these changing flows of energy and the different cultural attachments to energy people have. Now, I think this is quite important because I'm to some extent suspicious of the word geopolitics, I think. As an anthropologist who works primarily with people in a particular place, in a very local setting, I'm interested in everything that goes around them. But they would never use the word geopolitics to describe their experience of energy. So if there's an energy failure, it'll be about a local politician, or it'll be about corruption, or it'll be about a very specific environmental factor close to the border. So I think perhaps this is a limitation of anthropology, but perhaps it's also something we can kind of talk about, is how to make that transition from this very local, specific ethnographic knowledge to perhaps discussing something on a broader geopolitical level. I say I'm suspicious about geopolitics simply for the fact that I think it's very difficult to disentangle dominant narratives and dominant perceptions of particular states and how states act, and sort of ontologizing a state or a government as if it's existing in isolation. And as I mentioned, all of the kind of presumed cultural presuppositions that go behind that. So I think, again, this is something maybe we can talk about, we've spoken about before, is how to cross that scale, because there is a very fundamental gap between the geopolitics of Putin and the Yamal experience, but then also all of the other networks of people who are taking part in that flow, the workers, the scientists, the engineers, the map makers. There's a whole kind of process in between, which I think is really, really interesting to map and to monitor. How do we get to that point? And why is it that that particular vision of energy becomes the dominant one, ultimately? I think, finally, maybe I would just like to mention a bit about... Jonathan mentioned the issue about values, and I think this is perhaps something quite interesting. So if we think about energy as first and foremost a natural resource, but of course very quickly it becomes a political resource, it becomes a resource of actually cultural difference and sociality, really, more than anything else. So I think the whole question, the whole issue around values is really a question of culture, and it's really a question of how do particular values get attached to particular energy sources at particular times and particular moments, but also how then those change over time. And I think, I mean, I work on the Sino-Russian border, but I think any border context such as this highlights those tensions more than any other, because you have these flows of energy taking place across different moral, social, and political levels. I think I'll leave it there, and maybe we can talk about a few of the issues.